This is the Center for Strategic and International Studies Smart Women, Smart Power podcast. Welcome to the Smart Women, Smart Power podcast. I'm Beverly Kirk here at CSIS in Washington. Be sure to follow us on Twitter. You can find me at Beverly Kirk, and our Smart Women, Smart Power handle is at Smart Women. I am very honored today to welcome to the program the former president of Malawi, Her Excellency Dr. Joyce Banda. She is an activist and advocate for girls' education and maternal health, as well as an entrepreneur and philanthropist. Dr. Banda, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
First, let's talk about your work on improving access to education for young girls and your success in improving maternal health in Malawi for women. And then a bit later, if you don't mind, I'd love to talk to you about the U.S. relationship with Malawi and other African countries.
Okay.
So, you've said the Sustainable Development Goals, everybody knows them as SDG, focus on reaching adolescent girls between the ages of 10 and 14, and that's all good and well, but that more work needs to be done to reach the girl child younger than 10. So talk about what needs to be done and to be done and why you're focusing on this particular age group for young girls.
Yeah, I think to start with, let me start with correction. I've never said the Sustainable Development Goals focus on adolescent girls. I've been saying the developed world and experts, when they are supporting girls from the developing world, particularly Africa. And a particular example is the Obama administration. Very commendable work was done. They earmarked a lot of resources for the adolescent girl child from 11 to 14. And it was around health, education, economic empowerment, and harmful traditions. So my position is that if we, as an African woman leader, my observation is that when we start focusing on the girl child at age 11 to 14, it's too late. When we look at the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, the younger child, age 0 to 10, is adequately covered. The adolescent girl child is adequately covered. That is our agenda. And if you look at the Sustainable Development Goals, I think 1 all the way to 8 are talking about issues that affect women and children. So I'm not worried about the Sustainable Development Goals. I'm just worried at policy level in most countries, and it is an appeal because I'm not trying to underrate the work that has already been done. I am making an appeal that when we are focusing on the adolescent girl child, we must not lose sight of all the issues that she has to go through between the age of 0 to 10 that will subsequently affect how she progresses from 11 to 14.
And if we could delve deeper on some of the issues that young girls face between 0 and 10, talk about your concerns about what they face there.
My concern is that from 0 to 10, in a typical tradition, and without intending to harm the girl child, by tradition, the boys eat with their father, and the girls eat with their mother. And as an African, I know that if I'm a wife in this household, in the village, I'll give the best to my husband. So the boy child, unknowingly, is benefiting from better quality food than the girl child, because me and my girl child will eat last and least. This is at a time when the brain is developing. So the boy child is benefiting. Number two, then I am a victim myself. And I don't know how many other women who have not had the chance to be told are victims too, that we start working very hard when we are 2 years, overworked. And for me, I simply call it child labor. In my particular case, two doctors have told me that you must have started carrying very heavy stuff when you were too young. As a result, your spine is crooked. So I have health issues around my back for many years, and it is because by 5 years old, I'm already, and then they used to say, what a good child she is. She is able to carry a big pail of water on her head. The third is the defilement. We find now abuses towards the girl child. That is not happening between 11 and 14. It's happening between 0 and 10, where grown men are told by witch doctors that if they defile a girl child, they are cleansed of the HIV virus. I started talking about this almost 20 years ago. And I remember at one time when I said this, people told me, be careful not to talk about things that you have no evidence about. Now we know that it's happening all the time, that witch doctors are convincing men that if you sleep with a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, you get cleansed of the HIV virus. The number four is the discrimination against the girl child in as far as acquiring education is concerned. You find that when resources are low, families are sending boys to school and not girls. But also where girls are in child-headed households, then they're the ones who don't go. Or girls that are orphans, and there's a sick person in the house, they are the caretakers, they're the ones who don't go to school. I have opened a school in the village myself, and I have encouraged girls from child-headed households to come to school. But you find that they wake up in the morning, they have 4 siblings to look after, they have to hustle before they can come to any school, they have to cook, they have to find food, they just give up, they don't come to school. So most of these issues are happening between 0 and 10. Now the final one and most critical one is harmful traditions. Harmful traditions where I have seen an 8-year-old bride and I have seen a 9-year-old bride. In fact, I've got a photo that I can show you after this interview. So what I am saying is the harmful traditions are affecting girls not from 11 to 14 but from 0 to 10. Because there are so many areas in the developing world where even genital mutilation takes place before 10, 5, 6, 7. And even cleansing, you must have heard about this man in Malawi who boasted that he had slept with 103 girls on BBC. Those girls are being cleansed between 0 and 10. And the initiations in most parts of the world where girls are taken for initiation is between 0 and 10. And then they are even getting married now at 10. So we are saying, I am making a case in the paper that I published that leaders are born. And leaders are born with 30% leadership traits, because they are saying 70% has to be added on. Now I am saying, if this girl child is growing up in a household between 0 and 10 in that environment, and even if she has these 30% leadership traits, we can lose out. And that all that will go to waste.
How do you change that? I have so many questions. How do you change the tradition that says young girls between 0 and 8 or 9 have to work? How do you combat the practice of witch doctors telling men that if they sleep with a young girl, they're cleansed of HIV? How do you change that mindset? What has to happen? Because I know you were able to do some of these things in Malawi.
Yeah. I tested what we can do. I have tried some of these things. You know that in most of our countries, in Africa especially, we have chiefs, still chiefs, that are the custodians of tradition and culture. And I have found through experience that if you engage those, if you bring them on board, if you make them understand that they have a role to play, that they are champions just like yourself, even if you are in state house, you can have champions, because whatever they say, their subjects will listen. What I am trying to advocate for is change of mindset. In fact, in the paper that I have written and the book that I have written, I'm talking about that as the first recommendation, change of mindset. But the social mobilization of communities and engaging them and making sure that they change the way they value the girl child and the boy child at household level starts with the community and starts with the chief. So if we were able to engage chiefs around maternal death, maternal mortality, I know that we can also change opinion leaders and chiefs. We can engage them and recruit them to work around changing of mindsets.
And while you're talking specifically about Malawi and Africa writ large, that's not the only place where this kind of thing is happening, right?
Yeah. So, but changing, oh, yes. And in fact, in other areas, it's even worse. You know that in other areas, I'm talking about the child that is born between 0 and 10, but you and I know that in other parts of the world now, there was infanticide, and now there's embryocide. If I am pregnant and I have a girl, and I can't have a girl, I need a boy, you go and remove the pregnancy. That kind of thing, that's happening all over the world. For me, that's unfair to the unborn girl child. But I'm talking about where the girl child is born. And I know that there's so much more happening everywhere else, including dowry and so on, that stand in the way of the girl child achieving her full potential between 0 and 10 and be prepared now to go to school.
And you mentioned the book that you've written. Can you tell me more about it?
No, it's the book. What I did is I've spent the last year and a half working on this issue of women's participation in leadership. And the girl child, the attention we pay to the empowering the girl child between 0 to 10. I was privileged to participate as a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center and the Center for Global Development. So it was a joint fellowship. So at the Woodrow Wilson Center, I looked at leadership. Mm-hmm. But the two are related, because at the Center for Global Development, that's where I looked at the girl child 0 to 10. Mm-hmm. My concern is, what about the girl child born in this household that has leadership traits? So this leads to the paper at Woodrow Wilson Center, mm-hmm. that once we identify, spot this girl child with this leadership skill, signs at household level, how do we mentor her? Mm-hmm. How do we promote her? How do we educate her, mm-hmm. so that she becomes the leader she was born to be? Mm-hmm. And at the Woodrow Wilson Center, it is about how are we participating in leadership? What needs to be done for women to also be sitting at the policy formulating tables in order to participate in making decisions about issues that affect women and children? But so that paper, when it was published, it generated so much interest, the 0 to 10, so much so that people said, why don't you expand? Why don't you say more, as you are asking me? Say more. So in trying to say more, I then decided, well, why don't I just write a book on the same issue? So the name of that book is From Day One.
Ah.
From Day One, yes. So we're basically just talking about the 0 to 10. I have made several recommendations in that book, and as well as in the paper. Mm-hmm. Apart from change of mindsets, I'm also recommending that it's very important for us to begin to provide rights education from age 3. I'm thinking that when girls and boys go to early childhood education, to the nursery schools, that's where they must begin to be told what is right and what is wrong about them. Yeah, and so if a girl child is told from a very early age that it's not proper to be abused, it's not proper to be beaten, you are just as important as the boy child from a very young age. And the boy child, too, is made to understand that his sister is just as valuable as himself from a very early age. That's important. I belong to an organization called Think Equal. And Think Equal was started by a lady by the name of Leslie Udwin. She lives in the UK. So you can Google Think Equal. And that organization is advocating for what I'm saying, for rights education, apart from other things, to start from age 3, and now helping developing curricula that talks about that provides such education from age 3. And then lobbying governments to introduce it, working with UNESCO and other institutions. So now, as of January, about 116 countries had signed up and introduced Think Equal concept.
I want to ask one more question about this before we move on to talking about your work in maternal health. Right now, there's a lot of attention on women and women's rights and opportunities and challenges with the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movements. Can they be leveraged to draw attention to what you're talking about with the girl child? Is there a way to get people, since they're focused on women already right now, to look beyond the issues that have come up to the younger girl child and see these issues too as perhaps one part of a long continuum that impacts women overall?
I have found, and sometimes I'm told that I'm wrong, I have found that what our agenda as women should be to empower women, to promote women, to bring as women, as many women as possible to leadership positions, but that our approach will be different depending on where we come from and what can work there and our traditions and our culture in those parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And I say this because I have now had the privilege of living here for a year and a half, and I know that some of the approaches that are taken here, if we tried them in our part of the world, they may not work. And equally, those that are working here and trying so hard here to change attitudes and the habits would look at the way we approach things as a weakness. But that at the end of the day, we must look at, are we succeeding? Are we making progress or not? So being specific to the two issues that you raised about Me Too and the time is up, something like that.
Time's up.
Time's up. I think that we as African women met in June, concerned about what is happening to women and the slow pace at how we are being empowered in all fields, and formed what we are calling the African Leaders Network, African Women Leaders Network at the UN, under the auspices of UN Women and the African Union Gender Department. So for me, while here Me Too works, we should use that vehicle. That is the vehicle that we can use to make sure that we are focusing on these issues that I'm talking about the girl child 0 to 10. That works better for us. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you why. I was asked, speaking at the UN side meetings 2 years ago, what do you understand by feminism? How do you feel about the whole issue about feminism and what can you tell us? So I said, well, if I understand feminism very clearly, I believe that we in Africa will engage our men, will work with them, we shall not confront them, we shall not antagonize them, we shall not antagonize them, we shall not scream, we shall persuade, and we shall make a case and be persistent until issues change. And that's how we are doing it. And with here in America, you go on the street and you demonstrate, and at the end of the day, you get the same result I would get in Africa by being subtle about change. Then we should all consider ourselves winners. I cannot blame American women that they are doing it wrong, but equally, I would also want them to understand that we have to do it differently. Mm-hmm. And then this lady said to me, I don't want to agree with you. I can't agree with you. In fact, you are wrong. Because time is up, we've waited enough, we can't be diplomatic anymore, we want change, and we want space. I said, I thought you were asking me about Africa. And I said that with all due respect, because knowing that, Africa has had 4 female presidents. So we must be doing something right. So while we can be looked down upon that we are not doing it right, but we have had 4 female presidents. How many have you had? So what we need to do is to learn from one another and to ensure that if what we are doing is empowering more girls, empowering more women, protecting girls, and then what you are doing here is also working the same way, mm-hmm. that's fine. Mm-hmm. For me, I'm happy if both are working. But I can't judge to say that is right and this is wrong.
A very, very strong and good point. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Smart Women Smart Power podcast. I'm Beverly Kirk, and my guest is Her Excellency Dr. Joyce Banda, the former president of Malawi. Follow us on Twitter at Smart Women. Follow Dr. Banda at Dr. Joyce Banda, and let me spell that out for you. Dr. DrJoyceBanda. And you're also on Facebook, and I follow you on Twitter, so I know that you're very active on social media.
Yeah, yes, I am.
In getting your message out. I want to turn to your work on maternal health, because you have a very compelling personal story about how you got involved in advocating for women. And while you were president of Malawi, you led an effort that reduced maternal deaths in your country by 30%, which is simply incredible. Talk about your personal story and why it's important to make sure that women everywhere have access to good care.
As I've always said everywhere I've spoken, that I've been very fortunate that all the issues that I have championed have emerged from personal experience. So for me, getting into public office for 10 years and all the way to State House, that was a detour. I have spent my life on this platform, on the development platform. But it was all because of my personal experience on most of those issues. So education and health in particular. So on maternal health, on the 23rd of January 1984, I went to have my fourth born child, to give birth to my fourth born child, and suffered what they call postpartum hemorrhage. I was bleeding to death. And those who know, in our part of the world, bleeding after childbirth is the largest cause of death. But my husband knew one of the only three gynecologists at the hospital that time. He went and looked for Dr. John Chipangi and found him and brought him over, and he saved my life. And I remember by the time the doctor came, I had already collapsed. So I was on my way to die, really. And I remember for the 2 days that I stayed in hospital, people coming and saying, "You're still alive? You made it? How did that happen?" Because I was expected to die. And then I started asking myself what was happening to those that don't end up in a hospital. What was happening to those that end up at the traditional birth attendant? What are the statistics? I hadn't looked up until that time. By then, 1,200 women were dying giving birth per 100,000 live births. And then I asked myself, I am a Christian. Where in the Bible does it say we shall die giving birth? Like chicken. And why must it be that where we come from, we must die giving birth, when in America, when a woman is pregnant, it's a time of joy and expectation. All they are waiting for is a baby. They even go and register to start buying stuff, and they paint a room pink and blue, and we must die giving birth? I made up my mind at that point that I'll do all I can within my power to make sure that as long as I'm alive, mm-hmm. I refuse to accept that a woman should die giving life. So in 2009, when I became vice president, I was appointed by the African Union as goodwill ambassador for safe motherhood and maternal health. And that's when I started going in the villages, visiting hospitals, and seeing what was happening. I went into a very, very rural hospital one time and found that the only baby that night had died. And when I walked over to this girl, tears streaming. She managed to walk 15 kilometers to the clinic, but then she doesn't have a baby. What happened? Oh, there was no paraffin that night. And we were delivering this baby in the dark. I didn't have money to bring a candle with me. So my baby is dead. Obviously, the cord had gone around the neck. They had strangled the baby in the dark. In any other part of the world, that woman should have sued. This is a place where she doesn't even know her rights. And it was just one call to a private sector company and asked if they could provide electricity to this little clinic. And the telephone company in Malawi then was Zain, and in no time at all, they came and installed electricity. I was back in a month to switch on the lights. So sometimes it's just small things that you can do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, small things that you can do. But when I now became president, do you know being a president is a very powerful position? You can either build or destroy. And I decided, because I have always known that leadership is a love affair. You must fall in love with the people you lead, and the people must fall in love with you. And if you love your people, if you really have fallen in love with your people, It is not only leadership in State House. You will always stay alert and at the top and make sure that you protect those that you serve. So you will never want them to be exploited. You will never want them to die giving life. You will never want them to go hungry. And so I invited chiefs to State House. First assignment. Before I even appointed my cabinet, I invited leaders to State House. I mean to a hotel, all chiefs, they're about 350, and told them that I'm recruiting you as my fellow champions today, and we shall not allow a woman to die giving life in our village, because you have the power to tell every woman in that village to deliver at a clinic in the hands of a trained personnel. Mm-hmm. And then, in no time at all, there was congestion at the clinics, and I banned the delivery of babies by traditional birth attendants. And if not wanting to antagonize them and to lose them, built a mass, a critical mass of supporters of the women in the village from these traditional birth attendants. They became now the advisors to the young women. Mm-hmm. And so the chiefs made their own bylaws. If you deliver in my village, you will pay good, you will pay fine. So women, many, and then recruited men and sensitized them that their wives' pregnancy, these are small things that men have not been accustomed to. Not because they don't want to do it, but they just didn't know that they could do it. Because now, suddenly men started saying, yes, when my wife is pregnant, it's my responsibility. They buy a small bicycle in the village. They even wrote messages. I took Dr. Mary Robinson and Dr. Pumizile Mlango Nyuka, who is now head of UN Women, to the village in Malawi, where men had even written messages on their walls about how a real man cares for a pregnant wife. So we found that there was no congestion at the clinics because everybody was going to the clinic, and that's when I engaged the private sector to help us by building holding homes at the clinic, at the hospital, so that women can walk there slowly, 2 weeks before, a week before, and sit and stay there and wait for delivery close to trained personnel. Mm-hmm.
That is amazing. That is amazing. In the time that we have left, I have a couple of rapid-fire questions because I do want to engage you on the U.S. relationship with not only Malawi, but also other African countries. And I should note that while you were president of Malawi, you instituted economic reforms that turned the economy around in your country. And I want to use that point to ask you, is the U.S. missing opportunities to do business in countries like Malawi and other parts of Africa? Are U.S. businesses engaging? You mentioned several times here how you engage the private sector in terms of improving maternal health to provide the power. Do U.S. companies know about how many great opportunities they may find in your country or in other countries in Africa?
Do U.S. citizens know enough about Africa? That's another question. But
and your answer to that question would be?
No. Yeah, so I think what I know is that this country has the vehicle already. Africa Growth Opportunity Act that was signed by one of my favorite presidents of the U.S., President George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. The AGOA product is the vehicle we could use to grow trade between the U.S. and Africa. I was myself the first chair of the African and American Business Women's Alliance that we formed in the year 2000. So efforts have been made before. Mm-hmm. But my feeling is that we could do more. Mm-hmm. We could do more to grow trade between the two continents. Mm-hmm. And in any case, so if that happened efficiently and effectively, mm-hmm. We wouldn't need aid. Because it is trade that we must have. Because trade is more dignified than aid, because trade is about two parties that respect one another. But I feel that not enough trade is happening. And even the AGOA Act, it could also be improved upon. I haven't looked at it lately, but I know that we could do more. This current president has actually talked a lot about business. So it is my hope that during his time, we could do even more in encouraging trade between the U.S. and Africa. Now, we hear about this nationalistic policy that has come in America.
I was just going to follow up. The president's also said some not nice things.
To say America first, and the UK has said US first. I mean UK first. So it's a wind that is blowing. In most countries, they're thinking, let's look inside first. Let's empower ourselves first. Let's look after ourselves first. My position on that is two. One, it's an opportunity for Africa. It's an opportunity for Africa to look within as well and to say, well, fine, we must respect the position of America and the position of UK, but also to realize, as Africa, that we are not poor. And I don't know if you know this, that the richest man that ever lived on this earth was an African from Mali. His name was Musa Mansa. Mm-hmm. And you can Google him. Mm-hmm. He was 4 times Bill Gates. So my point is, look at what Bill Gates has done with his money, how he has touched humanity. And I have great respect for that couple. If indeed we had somebody who was richer than that, do we see it now? So we need to sit down and say, we are a rich continent. We have abundant natural resources. As long as we ensure that those natural resources benefit the people that we serve. And I'm talking to my fellow leaders, mm-hmm. that those natural resources don't belong to our pocket, they belong to the people. And there are countries on the continent of Africa that are making us proud, that they are using those resources for the benefit of their people, like Botswana, mm-hmm. like Ghana, and so on and so forth. So to come back to your question, if America says America first, what I'm seeing is that other countries are jumping in to fill that vacuum. Because as far as some of us are concerned that love this country, we have looked upon America as the leader. Now, when you abdicate that position of leadership, then others will fill up the position, and it's unfortunate.
And I want to follow up with, we're quickly running out of time. You said that you're hopeful that the current president will, who's talked about business, will see business opportunities to trade, to improve trade with African countries. But he's also made some not nice comments about African countries. How do you respond? How do you react to that, even though you're optimistic that he'll see the business opportunity that's in front of him?
You know, when I first heard that, I was deeply hurt, just like all Africans who reacted that week. But then I thought again and I said, This America, I am heavily indebted to this America. I am what I am because of this country. So that's how Republican and Democratic presidents and leadership in the past have done to make some of us what we are. President W. Bush, just through PEPFAR alone, 56 million Africans got testing and counseling, and 7 million Africans got treatment. So now, if a president comes and insults me, that's a human being, that's one person. So for me, President Trump can stay 4 years, 8 years. If he still feels that way, if he seriously feels that way, and if he really said it, he will go. But America shall remain, and that's what matters to me.
Dr. Joyce Banda, thank you so much for spending time with me.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. Remember to follow us on Twitter. I'm at Beverly Kirk, and we're at Smart Women. And follow Dr. Banda at Dr. Joyce Banda. Thanks for joining us. Thank you for listening. For more information, go to csis.org and subscribe to our podcasts.